My talk today is entitled Vows and Sexuality. Sexuality is a powerful part of the human experience. It can be so wonderful, amazing, pleasurable, intimate. It can also be very frustrating. It can be harmful, and it can be really traumatic. The Buddhist tradition understands sexuality as having this huge range of impacts on our lives. And so if you look at, there are sort of five central precepts that run throughout Buddhism, vowing not to kill, not to steal, not to lie, not to intoxicate, and not to misuse sexuality. And, you know, we, our basic vow here when people take the precepts around this is, I vow not to misuse sexuality, but to be caring and faithful in intimate relationships. And we have many people in MZMC who are preparing this year to take the precepts formally and take these vows. And also the people in practice period, we are studying the paramitas. And on Wednesday, we'll begin our focus on Sila, which is Buddhist ethics. This vow is central to the entire history of Buddhist ethics. The vow not to misuse sexuality, but to be caring and faithful in intimate relationships is rooted in a central principle of Buddhist conduct and thought, which is ahimsa, which can be translated as non-harming or non-violence. I want to just kind of get clear on this. I'm going to come clean at the beginning about some ways that I think people can have healthy and honest expressions of this vow. I'm just going to read this off because I wanted to, this is not intended to be entirely comprehensive, but at least it gets you a general overview. So I think people can enact this vow while having sex a lot, a little, or not at all, with other people, and or by oneself. Also, we can embody this vow enjoying things that we find erotic, having sexual and or romantic relationships with different sex, same sex, different gender, and or same gender people. And I'd like to make explicit that includes intersex and gender non-conforming people, dating or not dating, being celibate, as many monastics I know are celibate, being asexual, and being in monogamous and polyamorous relationships. That is not intended to be an exhaustive list. So if I left out some mode of expressing your sexuality that you think is healthy, you may well be right. My attitude towards sexuality is informed by the Buddhist tradition and my training, but also very much by contemporary research on sexuality. In some ways, it varies from what we see in the Buddhist textual tradition. And we'll dig a little bit more into that part of it later in the talk. I just want to talk about like healthy expressions of this vow. You know, not misusing sexuality, it's deliberately vague. So actually there are not a lot of, you know, in a lot of Buddhist texts, they'll say it's not misuse sexuality, and then you get 10 subsets and 10 subsets of the subsets. I have not been able to find very many such things. So this vow makes room for culture to change and to recognize the diversity of views people have about sexuality, which are really, as I think you probably know, really broad. But it points fundamentally to non-harming, to really embodying and engaging with our sexuality in a way that doesn't cause harm. So generally speaking, in most Buddhist texts, this is only expressed in the negative, not to misuse sexuality. It's been common in some places to include a positive expression of the vow, and we do that at our Zen Center when we intone this vow. I vow not to misuse sexuality, but to be caring and faithful in intimate relationships. Caring. So this is about being genuinely interested in, inquisitive in, curious about, and compassionate in about ourselves, people we are with, and people who are affected by what we're doing. So this may sound kind of just like Buddhism to you, but we're bringing it very specifically into the question of how we embody our sexuality. And, you know, to do this personally, you know, it's not to get stuck on our ideas, but actually keep investigating. We can keep growing. We can keep being more free with other people talking about it. We are conditioned not to talk about sexuality. It may be a little nervous to give this talk. I'll probably blush, you know? So it's like, wow, this is a thing that's sort of held down in discourse. And there are reasons for that. And I'll actually talk a little bit about that in a minute. But, you know, talking to people and actually hearing what they want to say. And hearing from people who might be affected by your sexual conduct, by, you know, just finding ways to hear those voices. It's important. It's important. Faithful. So the thing is, I'm not sure who wrote this particular iteration of this vow. They may have meant that you should only have sex if you're in a monogamous relationship. I don't believe that. So, but I do think you can be faithful. To me, faithful has two main components. It's being truthful and it's being reliable. So to not be truthful with people is to not hold faith with them. And to not be reliable, to just sort of, you know, it's like, oh, we just hooked up and then I disappeared. That's not being faithful, or being really unpredictable in your behavior. That's not faithful. So we can be truthful and stable with people in many different ways of engaging in sexuality. But I really encourage you to do so. So, you know, this topic is personal to me. I do not by any means speak from a mountaintop on this subject. I like to be forthright. You know, I personally have engaged in a lot of unhealthy and harmful sexual behavior when I was younger. And it caused huge amounts of grief for me and other people. And, you know, I was able to do a lot of transformation and healing and change and repair relationships with many people and with myself, for which I'm very grateful. But by the time I got to the Zen Center, I was in much better shape, and I felt like I was enacting my values a lot better, but I really still wasn't clear, and I was still doing things that I wouldn't do now. And, you know, I just brought this to my teacher, Tim. Tim Burkett is my Zen teacher, and I would, you know, because I had a vow to not misuse sexuality and to be caring and faithful in intimate relationships, I would talk to my teacher about how I was enacting that vow or wasn't. And he was so helpful, you know, and he was helpful because he really did a good job of giving me some guidance, but making space for me to discern what my values were, how I could develop those values to be more complete and compassionate, and then how to put those into action. And, you know, this is the flavor of this vow, and it is sort of the flavor of how we teach here, I hope, is to really make space for people to be discerning, autonomous, and find their growth. So this is not about a demand or a power over situation that says you have to do your sexuality thus. So that's something about healthy enactments of this vow. But, you know, it's really, I think it's important, you know, if you're going to talk about sexuality, if I'm going to talk about sexuality, to acknowledge that many, many people have experienced trauma around sexuality. In particular, sexual violence is endemic to our society, and there's quite a bit of discourse about it in early Buddhist literature as well. So we know this has been going on for a long time. It's really improbable that there are not numerous people in this group who haven't experienced sexual trauma. And it's really, you know, I just hope we can pause and hold in our hearts that that is the case. And that there is a deep need for healing and for transformation of our culture and ourselves so people can be safe. And so people can be well. So this does connect with sexual violence. Often is connected to a abuse of power. So sexual violence, to some extent or in some categories, comes down to the question of consent. If you want to be engaging in sexual activities with other people, you need to have affirmative, positive, and enthusiastic consent. But consent is complicated by power. So if you're someone's boss, there's no way for them to engage in genuine consent because you have power over them. So if they do not acquiesce, they are creating other problems for themselves. And this is a big deal in spiritual and religious communities. As many of you know, many Buddhist communities have been plagued, and within certainly American Buddhism and probably Buddhism worldwide, there has been endemic abuse of power sexually by teachers. So it's really, and this has happened here at MZMC. It's been quite a few years, but it's true. And it is important to acknowledge it. Because the first noble truth is we look suffering in the face. And the second noble truth opens up the door to being able to see the reason suffering exists and to take action. So at MZMC, you know, we provide training for people who are in positions of power in how to take care of their sexuality, to practice good boundaries around sexuality. And I just want to read you, you know, we just remade the Essex statements for MZMC. And if you have never looked at it, I really encourage you to read it. It's right on the website in the About tab. I just want to read you the passage on sexuality between teachers and students, which is the ethics policy is listed in a period of a group of canons. So you have to follow these canons, or you're in violation of the ethics. It is a violation of these canons for a teacher or teacher trainee to begin a sexual relationship with a student or sangha member. This does not apply to relationships that pre-existed a teacher's ordination or relationships that are with a person who is unaffiliated with MZMC at the time the relationship was instituted. So if that last part sounds legalistic, it's basically like a relation, you can't, like I could have, if my wife, who I never had anything to do with MZMC before we became involved, decides to join the Sangha and start practicing, that is okay. That would be one way to think of it. So anyway, it's important. And you know, if you see violations of this, please speak up. And if we hear about them, we need to collectively have the will to take action. Really important. There's a possibility to not keep doing the same thing. That's the basic teaching of Buddhism. Okay, so I'm going to shift gears. A couple weeks ago, we had a meeting, may have been the first one framed this way, I don't really know, a gathering of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer questioning, and beyond people. And it was awesome. I just got to say, for anyone who was there, I offer a bow to you. It was just so beautiful. And, you know, we got a lot of people in those categories in this community. I would guess at least 10%. So it was just really felt good to me as a bisexual person and other people to just kind of have our own space and share. You know, affinity is powerful. Affinity is powerful. And you may or may not know that there have been gay and lesbian people in senior leadership at MCMC for at least 25 years. But anyway, it was cool. And, you know, I just bring this up because, you know, I think there are a lot of people here who may be of a culture where being accepting of these things is so normative, we forget that it's actually very fraught, complicated culturally. You know, there are kids whose parents are sending them to conversion camp probably today who will be profoundly traumatized, you know, and we have great culture wars over transgender identity, and people are still, including me, are like, oh, what's gender nonconforming mean exactly? You know, what are we including in the category of queer? And so the thing is, we can keep growing. Hey, everybody, we can actually keep learning about other people and expanding our capacity for people to be free. How cool is that? That sounds like Buddhism to me. So, you know, I'm bisexual, and I've known this for probably almost 40 years. And many, many other people have known it for about 30 years. But, you know, I've been in a monogamous relationship with Colleen Clish, who is now my wife, for about a dozen years. And so it doesn't come up very much. You know, there's just not that many places where it will be very evident. But I was having a conversation with a friend of mine a couple of years ago. And he's a pretty woke person. You know, really hardcore social justice activist, constantly trying to learn about new people and the particularities of their identities and how to care for and include them. And, you know, noticing anytime he wants to deny their difference or deny the value of their particular perspective. And, you know, just wonderful. But anyway, he was over here for lunch. And we were talking about sexuality. And I'm like, well, I'm bisexual. And he's like, what? I didn't know that. And I was like, yeah, yeah. And he's like, oh, cool. And then he's like, how does that work with your marriage? And I was really puzzled for a minute. I didn't exactly know what he meant. And then I was like, oh, I still don't know exactly what he meant, but it's pretty simple. It's like, I'm bisexual and I love my wife. And the way we have chosen to have our relationship is as monogamous. That's how it works. It's pretty good. So anyway, the reason I tell this story is because, you know, we don't know. He was like, how does that work? You know, he doesn't know. And, you know, fortunately, we had a relationship of love and trust where he could ask me that question. And I don't have a lot of fraught feelings about my identity, so it didn't feel too painful. But it is good to know that, you know, when we misunderstand someone or make an assumption about what their sexuality or their gender will entail, you know, it can be really painful for people. So it's good to just, you know, to be curious and be learning, but really be sensitive when we talk to people about this and make space for them to show what they are, show what they are. So now I'm gonna move towards, you know, looking at the textual tradition. So this topic is really big. But generally speaking, if you read early polycanon texts, well, how to put this? I'll use one of their formulas. So we're talking about the early layer of Buddhism, which is a little different than how we teach it, certainly in a Mahayana tradition and a Zen center and in the United States and so forth. But there's a formula that the Buddha uses over and over and over again. He says, you should know the gratification, the danger, and the escape. The gratification, the danger, and the escape. He said, what is the gratification? It's pleasure. So you do something, feels good. There's gratification. Some of us may have experienced that with sexuality. It's possible. So the danger, he says, is that we become attached to the pleasure and we become bound to wanting more of it. And the escape is to not want more of it. Pretty simple. And escape, that's nirvana. It's like not wanting something else is nirvana. So Polycanon texts are a little bit ambivalent in the degree to which they say pleasure will inherently lead towards attachment and desire and is to be avoided. There's a lot of texts that really indicate that. But then there are quite a few that suggest that the problem is not the pleasure itself, but the shift that we make from pleasure to attachment and desire and wanting something else. And this second position, which makes room for us to totally experience the pleasure of being in embodied form without becoming attached, so being really here with everything and enjoying it when it's beautiful and when it feels good, but being free from self-centered acquisitiveness, this is a more upheld in the Mahayana tradition. And at the end of this talk, I'll read you a passage from the Gandhabhuha from the Avatamsaka Sutra, which I hope will give you some of this flavor. So I should say, you know, people's sexual behavior can become quite compulsive. And, you know, compulsion is essentially, it's a pretty basic thing that Buddhism is interested in helping us be free of. And to be more free from things that are compulsive takes practice and it takes support and it takes kindness. So, you know, if you feel like there are elements of your sexual behavior that you would like to change but really struggle to change, I encourage you to get help to do it from other human beings. Human beings that you can trust, and then be patient with yourself. But also realize, yeah, it's cool to be more free. That's possible. So, you know, Pema Chodron, she gave us that book called Start Where You Are. And this is very useful when it comes to sexuality. Start where you are. But, yeah. So also people sometimes like we can get very repressed about our sexuality. So there may be things about that your mind produces as erotic that you're like, no, that's bad. You know, as a person from the queer community, I can say, I know about that. You know, it's not like it was like, that's fine. It's cool to be sexually attracted to men. There were a lot of things telling me that wasn't true. So, but you know, the range of stuff can get really big. And my understanding is there's a lot of research that says many people have lots of things that are intensely erotically charged in their experience that are really not what they would normally talk about, that are quite taboo, that we would call in the parlance of my old younger community, pretty freaky. So yeah, you may not have any freakiness going on, but you may have some freakiness going on. And I'm here to just say, yeah, welcome to the human race. It's all right. You know, suppressing and quashing, this is where early Buddhist texts will often suggest we should just sort of really move away from any of that really intense sexual energy that's freaky. There may be wisdom to that, but, you know, contemporary research on sexuality suggests that that is not a good idea. And I'm just going with this more modern, postmodern view. I think also a more Mahayana view, which really honors, like if you read Mahayana literature, it shows this profusion of imagination. And some of the stuff is violent or bizarre. And it's just, people have all this stuff in them. And we need to actually honor it and then find a way to respond to it that's compassionate and beneficial. So one thing I like to, a simple way to think about this is if you think about like your real root values, like compassion, kindness, connection, stuff like that, and put it up against whatever kind of freaky stuff is going on in your erotic imagination and where those overlap, that's what you can be doing with other, that's a good thing to be doing with other people. And the stuff that's just like really out there, well, you can honor that on your own time and be patient with it and enjoy it and enjoy it. So one of the reasons sexuality has a lot of power is the degree to which it's not talked about and the degree to which it's suppressed that gives things power. And so we do have a subtle art between really honoring privacy and cultural norms around talking about sexuality while also making space for more of us to really be seen. Because secrets produce shame, and shame is corrosive and harmful. So, you know, finding contexts where you can like let your sexual self be known and seen is really, really helpful. But being discerning about where are good places to do that is very important. So, I do want to get into this Gandavyuha Avatamsaka Sutra. So, you know, we have a lot of early Buddhist literature that's pretty down on sexuality. I'm not really emphasizing that here, but it's to be acknowledged. And actually, there's a lot of misogyny because of a lot of the teachings are directed towards male celibate monks. You see a lot of projection, misogynist projection on sexuality on women. And so there's a lot of stuff in the Buddhist tradition that's just really not admirable, in my opinion. But there are a lot of resources that I think can help us. So anyway, in the Mahayana, you start to see a tendency to have a different attitude towards pleasure. So I like to cite from the Surangama Sutra, there's a passage where 16 bodhisattvas enter a bathhouse together and all simultaneously attain enlightenment on feeling the contact of the water on their skin. Just the pleasure of being in the baths with other people is an awakening experience. And it's certainly not an explicitly erotic story, but it, you know, I would say they're erotic in the root sense of just being about sensual pleasure, clearly there. So you really probably wouldn't find that in an early Buddhist sutra, but in the Mahayana, it's actually included in a number of koans as well. And we have a picture of it. Oh yeah, when we get back to the Zen Center, I don't know if it'll still be there, but in the bathroom altar, you know, when you're going to go to the bathroom during formal practice, we bow to the altar at the bathroom to remind ourselves that everything is practice. And right above the altar there, the altar image is the image of the 16 bodhisattvas entering the bath together. Anyway, so we have a different attitude. So I want to read this passage from the Avatamsaka, the Flower Garland Sutra. The last chapter of the Avatamsaka is called the Gandavyuha. You don't have to remember any of this. I just like saying the words because they're so beautiful. And in this Gandavyuha chapter, well, let me say, the Avatamsaka is known as being kind of the apex of Buddhism that emphasizes interdependence and skillful means in terms of recognizing that everyone is approaching the moment from a very distinct perspective, and that's really vast how different those can be, and everyone needs to be met in terms of liberation from that particular perspective, and people can use all different kinds of means to help people be free. So in the Gandavyuha chapter, it's a story of a young man named Sudana who becomes really deeply called to engage in liberation of all beings from suffering. which is what we're supposed to be doing here at MZMC. And so he goes and visits a series of, I don't remember the number, it's like 90 unbelievably incredible teachers. And everyone gives him this amazing teaching that's like so complete, and then says, yeah, but you know, try this next person, they're gonna have something great. And he keeps learning from this diversity, this range of different views. So he encounters a lot of different kinds of people. And the passage I'm gonna talk about is in his encounter with Vashumitra, who has the same name as like a totally other, like Theravadin scholar. But anyway, Vashumitra. And Vashumitra is female, as are many of the teachers in the Gandavyuha, is really good looking. And her mode of teaching, I would say, is explicitly erotic. And I will say, you know, a feminist analysis of this passage, would, you could easily write a couple dissertations, which would be very helpful, but I don't have time to do that. What I can say is, although the erotic is associated with the female body in this story, there are actually many men in the Gandavyuha who are described in extremely about their physical beauty. And there is another one whose principal means of teaching is physical touch. So anyway, that's just a little bit of framing. And, you know, with the Gandavyuha, I think it is nice to approach the text when I'm reading as a meditation practice. And when I'm reading it to you, I invite you to experience it as a, you know, kind of evoke that meditative quality of mind. So if you'd like, I invite you to close your eyes so that your attention can be focused on letting the sounds come into your ear, and then let your imagination produce the images of what is being narrated in this story. And I have abridged this pretty thoroughly. The Gandavyuha is very wordy. This will be about a 5-minute reading, so enjoy. So this is Sudana arrives at a town looking for Vashumitra. People there who did not know Vashumitra's virtues or the scope of her knowledge said to Sudana, "What has someone like you with senses so calm and subdued, so aware, so clear, without confusion or distraction, your gaze focused discreetly right before you, your mind not overwhelmed by sensation, your mind so cool and steady, your way of life profound, wise, and oceanic? What have you to do with Vashumitra? You should not have any lust for her. Your head should not be turned by her. You should not have any such impure thoughts. You should not be under the power of a woman. You should not do what should not be done." Those who knew the excellence of the virtues of Vashumitra, however, and who were aware of the scope of her knowledge, said, "Good, good, you have really made a gain if you ask about Vashumitra. You surely seek Buddhahood. You surely want to make yourself a refuge for all sentient beings. You surely want to extract the barbs of passion from all sentient beings. You surely want to transform the notion of purity. Vashumitra is in her house, north of the town square." There he saw Vashumitra. I skipped a passage where he walks there. There he saw Vashumitra, who was beautiful, with golden skin and black hair, her limbs and body well-proportioned, more beautiful in form than all celestial and human beings in the realm of desire. Her voice finer even than that of the god Brahma. She knew the language of all beings. She had a pleasant voice that could pronounce any sound. She was well-versed in all arts and sciences. She had learned to use the magic of true knowledge, and she had mastered all aspects of skillful means of bodhisattvas. Sudana went up to Vashumitra, paid his respects, and said, "Noble one, I have set my mind on supreme perfect enlightenment, but I do not know how to learn and carry out the practice of a bodhisattva. I hope you will tell me how a bodhisattva is to learn and carry out the practice of enlightening beings." She said, "I have attained an enlightening liberation called ultimately dispassionate. To gods, in accord with their inclinations and interests, I appear in the form of a goddess of surpassing splendor and perfection. And to all other types of beings, I accordingly appear in the form of a female of their species of surpassing splendor and perfection. And all who come to me with minds full of passion, I teach them so that they become free of passion. Those who have heard my teaching and attain dispassion achieve an enlightening concentration called the realm of non-attachment. Some attain dispassion as soon as they see me and achieve an enlightening concentration called the light in joy. Some attain dispassion merely by talking with me and achieve an enlightening concentration called treasury of unimpeded sound. Some attain dispassion just by holding my hand and achieve an enlightening concentration called basis of going to all Buddha's lands. Some attain dispassion just by embracing me and achieve an enlightening concentration called the womb receiving all sentient beings without rejection. Some attain dispassion just by kissing me and achieve an enlightening concentration called contact with the treasury of virtue of all beings. All those who come to me, I establish in this enlightening liberation of ultimate dispassion on the brink of the stage of unlimitedness. So clearly, given my earlier comments, I do not think that sexuality and eroticism is an appropriate means of teaching Dharma from a teacher perspective. However, this sutra shows that a person can engage fully with their sexuality and with other people in a way that is beautiful, that joyful, that's freeing, and that does not produce further suffering and waiting for something else to happen. Now, in practical terms, well, I should say, the actual first teaching that the Buddha gave, according to the Pali Canon, is a middle way between self-mortification and grasping at sensual pleasure. In Vashramitra's teaching here, she keeps talking about dispassion and joy and delight. And so it's a little mysterious. It has this paradoxical language that we're accustomed to if we hang out with Mahayana literature a lot. So it doesn't give you an easy answer, but it does open up a possibility that the wholeness of our lives, including our sexuality, can be part of our collective path of liberation.